Good evening, everyone. I'd like to dedicate my talk tonight to the well-being of Nico the cat, who is a cat that lives in my house and is pretty ill right now. So my talk tonight is on the theme of wisdom. And I don't know how much Nico knows about wisdom, but maybe a lot. Maybe Nico is wisdom, just her life, you know. So anyway, I don't think she can understand these words, but nevertheless, I offer her my blessing. Tonight, I have the great honor to introduce a new figure on our altar. This is with the support of the Valley Streams Board. I am donating this statue of Manjushri. There, we had a statue of Manjushri on our altar. Manjushri is the bodhisattva, or the enlightening being of wisdom. And we had a statue, but it was rather diminutive. And we got this larger statue recently from our great friend, Attention Rev Anderson. I thought, well, this one, which is bigger, would make a better companion to the Kuan Yin. So the board thought that would be a good idea too. So we swapped. I'm going to take the little Kuan Yin as mine for my home altar, and this one, Manjushri, and Manjushri will, this bigger Manjushri will live here in the Zendo and be on our altar. So now we have on our altar, we have Prajnaparamita, which is the larger figure, which is the mother of all Buddhas. And we have an image of a monk, a Buddhist monk. And we have these twin companion of bodhisattvas who represent compassion and wisdom, great principles of Buddhism. Dave quipped that now we're working on a full complement of Mahayana action figures, which I thought was amusing. Maybe we'll get some more at some point. Oh, we didn't have everybody. Sorry, we didn't know you were not in the room yet.
We can hear the bell.
Oh yes, we need to ring the bell louder. Yes, Oscar. Well, a lot of people are under that impression, but the lack of a teaching mudra indicates to me that somehow it's, you know, in other words, that figure is in this posture, this cosmic mudra. So, I don't think generally speaking that figure would necessarily be identified by anyway, as a Buddha, but you know. But let's not split hairs, you know.
Would it not have Buddha nature?
Well, that's a good question. Would it pass through fire, for instance? But that's not the point of the talk. So, Or that's not. I am going to bring up a Zen story or a koan tonight, but that's not the one. There is one about, can a wood Buddha pass through fire? But that's not the one I'm talking about tonight. So Manjushri, who I am talking about tonight, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, he's usually represented in the habit or the garb of a prince. And so he, you know, this fellow has, you know, some decorative items, and he has a crown and so forth. So we. Oh, sorry. I have to be careful with my gestures. Sorry. So anyway, he's identified in the garb of a prince, and he's holding a sword over his head as if poised to strike. And of course, the sword represents wisdom in the sense of the capacity to cut through affliction or delusion, to cut through the hindrances which block our vision of the true nature of things, the empty nature of things. So, and Manjushri is particularly revered in the Zen school, and appears in a number of sutras as a character. One of the most famous is he is the only bodhisattva in the Vimalakirti Sutra who is willing to go and converse with the indomitable Vimalakirti. All the other bodhisattvas in the sutra say, "Oh no, I don't want to go see Vimalakirti. The last time I went to see him, he outdid me in understanding of the Dharma, and I don't want to go back to see him." But Manjushri turned out to be the bodhisattva who was willing to go at the Buddha's request to actually dialogue with Vimalakirti. And sometimes Manjushri is known as called the father of all Buddhas. So as you've probably heard, Prajnaparamita is called the mother of all Buddhas. And here we have someone who is sometimes called the father of all Buddhas. So these are spiritual partners who are devoted to the principle and practice of wisdom. Manjushri's sword. The sword of Manjushri, it's easier to say it that way for some reason. The sword of Manjushri represents kind of active principle of our practice. On the one hand, as I said, with the stroke, cutting through affliction, cutting through delusion, but also the sword represents what clears the way, what might be left after the stroke is completed, which is a clear, empty field of awareness. So on the one hand, cutting through delusion, on the other hand, opening up awareness, opening up wisdom. So that brings me to the case in the Book of Serenity that I did plan to bring up, which is, so the Book of Serenity is a collection of Zen stories or koans, and this is the number 68 in that book, and it's called Jiashan, Swings the Sword. So it goes like this. monk asked Jishan, you should, he asked, how is it to get rid of the dust to see the Buddha? How is it to get rid of the dust to see the Buddha? And Jishan said, you should directly swing the sword. If you don't swing the sword, the fisherman stays in the nest. I know you're going to have questions about that, but let's hold those. Concentrate on the first part. You should directly swing the sword. So the monk took that in, and but, you know, he may have said, what? He may have had a quizzical look. And so he went to another teacher and asked the same question. How is it when getting rid of the dust to see the Buddha? And the other teacher, Shishuan, said, he has no country. Where will you meet him? He has no country. Where will you meet him? So there's a little more to the story, but I think for those that are familiar with the Platform Sutra, where there is some talk about cleansing the surface of a mirror to get rid of the dust. And this monk's question seems to, I think he's knowledgeable about this particular story that came down many years before, that that happened in the presence of the sixth ancestor. So anyway, I think you might understand that this idea of clearing the dust off the mirror is like swinging the sword to clear the afflictions or delusions of the mind. Of course, you have to be careful when taking the dust off a mirror with a sword. You might scratch a metaphor. But anyway, that's the sense of Jishan's answer. You know, you must directly swing the sword. You must clear this dust off this mirror of the mind, all these afflictions, and then, you know, you'll see clearly. But Jishan has a kind of different take on it. I mean, he says, I think of him, as this came up in Zazen, I think of Shishuan as sort of an earlier day John Lennon. He says, imagine there's no countries. Imagine there's no countries. It's easy if you can. Right? So Buddha has no countries. No, there's no boundaries there. There's no definition to this place. It's a wide open place. It has lots of space and freedom there. So where will you meet Buddha? You'll meet Buddha in a place of no boundaries, place of freedom from, you know, constricting ideas about dust covering things and so forth. So it's quite a nice story, I think, about the sword. So I feel like pretty soon I'm going to be in a comedy routine here. Anthony, you left me. Okay, I'm going to try something different. I'm going to grab more fabric. There. I think that'll stay. So, recently, shifting gears a little bit, recently I had an opportunity to spend quite a bit of time in nature. I went on vacation to Montana, and one day I was looking, I was just walking around, I don't know, and I was, but I was around a lot of creeks and rivers and so forth, and it occurred to me that human consciousness, that we had just done it. We had just done a half-day sitting, I think, before I left, and it was quite a good half-day sitting, and I was kind of carrying that half-day sitting with me to Montana, and I was able to do my practice there as well in the morning, and anyway, then I was out, you know, in the day seeing these streams and so forth, and I thought, you know, human consciousness is like a braided stream. You know, braided stream is one that, you know, it's unified, starts out unified, and then it comes to some kind of terrain where it goes in myriad directions, and then eventually, almost always, it comes back into one. And so, you know, this is, I thought, a good metaphor for human consciousness, because human consciousness has a great many braids, a great many places it can go. Some of those include memory. You know, we can get lost in memory. We can get, I don't say lost, but anyway, we can go down the path of memory, or the stream, the rivulet, to keep with the metaphor. Go down the rivulet of memory. We can go down the rivulet of desire. We can go down the rivulet of dreams, or dreaming, or planning. And of course, all these fall in the general category. All these rivulets could be named discursive thinking, thinking that wanders here and there, lots of places for our thought to spread out and go off in different directions. And so this mind, our mind can follow these different courses like a braided stream. And actually, in Buddhism, we have a whole sub-school of studying the braided streams. It's called Abhidharma. It's studying the myriad dharmas, the myriad possibilities of human consciousness. And it's called, you know, it's Buddhist psychology, so to speak. But wisdom is more interested. Maybe wisdom practice is more interested in studying or discovering the kind of terrain that brings all the rivulets. What kind of terrain of the mind brings all the rivulets back into one stream? So this is, you know, and just, if I don't belabor this metaphor too much, you know, in nature, streams don't just, you know, wander their way through valleys. They actually, you know, cut their way through valleys. And the one stream is the most effective. You know, when all the current is in one place, it's the most effective at cutting through the terrain. So our practice is to cut through all the productions of the mind. to cut through all the productions of the mind, to tend toward the one stream that goes deep and cuts through just like the sword. So cutting through the productions of the mind is like no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. It's cutting through all, even the most basic factors, the most basic phenomena with which we are identified, cutting through all that we are identified with, even the most basic, like seeing and hearing, touching and tasting, feeling. Is there some experience that's beyond that? So we're tending in that direction in our practice. We're tending in that direction, and we're always dealing in the next instant, even as we might imagine that we have accomplished something. We have cleared out the territory a bit. There's always another production, you know. There's always some other production of the mind. So, you know, Jiushan says, you should directly swing the sword. And he doesn't mean there's an occasion for swinging the sword and then there's an occasion for something else. There's always swinging the sword. There's always swinging the sword. And maybe at some point there seems to be less resistance. There's less there to cut away, and so we enjoy that experience of Dungshan. Like Dungshan says, go to the place where there's no grass for 10,000 miles, nothing to cut down. In other words, no lawn mowing for 10,000 miles. No grass, no arisings. Mm-hmm. So I was fearing that this Dharma talk might be a little bit, have too many themes, but here goes another one. Sorry. I do my best. So I was listening. It's related, though. Trust me. I was listening to Dharma talk by Richard Baker Roshi, who was my first teacher in Zen. And he used to be abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. And he's getting quite elderly at this point. In fact, a couple of days after he gave this talk I listened to, he had a stroke. So, but anyway, he's still on top of his game, and even after the stroke, I understand that he is too. And he was talking at the San Francisco Zen Center, and he said something like, I didn't go back and listen to it, but it was something like the most important words in Zen are Hishiryo, Hishiryo. Those are Japanese words. And those words mean non-thinking or beyond thinking. Hishiryo. And he says something like, yeah, these are the most important words in Zen practice. Hishiryo. And I kind of think so. I think he has a point. Hishiryo, is translated non-thinking, and it's also translated beyond thinking. And our good friend Reverend Neo, translates it as unthinking. I very much like that translation, because when you come to that famous story that Dogen briefly encapsulates in a certain text called The Universal Recommendation to Practice Zazen. He encapsulates his story from which this Hishiryo comes, and the story, the very brief encapsulation by Dogen is 3 points for practice. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. And then Dogen says, and this is what Baker Roshi is probably picking up, this is the essential art of Zazen. This is the essential art of Zazen. So, but I very much like Mio's unthinking. Because to me, whereas non-thinking sounds like some sort of state that you reach, some sort of, mystical place of complete peace or something, which I'm not putting down. But unthinking to me is more like a process. To me, it implies more like a process of what we're doing in Zazen. We're thinking, and then we're in this process of studying our thinking, letting go of our thinking, and that process is unthinking. That whole process is unthinking. So I very much like that novel translation that Mio has offered to us in the past. So I'm going to try to bring my metaphors together here. This process of unraveling thinking, or like the stream that reaches one channel. We have a name for this, and we call it Zazen. We call that process, that activity, Zazen. And in our school, in our Soto Zen school, we say that there is an equivalency between, or a non-difference between the practice of Zazen and the activity of wisdom, or the practice of wisdom. And this is an essential point that is brought out in the aforementioned Platform Sutra, where the sixth ancestor says, "Good friends, our teaching takes meditation," or Zazen, I'll say Zazen, takes Zazen and wisdom as fundamental. Everyone, do not say in your delusion that Zazen and wisdom are different. Zazen and wisdom are one essence, not different. Meditation, or Zazen, is the essence of wisdom, and wisdom is the function of Zazen. So, why are Zazen and wisdom not different? Why are they not different? This is just one possible answer that I'll give, but among many, I think, that could be stated, but I would say that Zazen and wisdom both come to life when we're closely examining and closely studying the activity of our body, speech, and mind. That's where Zazen and meditation both come to life. Excuse me, wisdom and Zazen both come to life. That's where each of those activities, because wisdom is an activity, I'm proposing it, wisdom is an activity, not a fixed state. It's an activity, and Zazen's an activity of the of studying body, speech, and mind. And that's where both those principles come to life and are turned over and realized. And in that process, if you're lucky, and if you persist with some constancy, you recognize your own mind. You recognize your own mind as wisdom. There's a recognition. You see your own mind as wisdom. And in the next moment, you swing the sword again, because that perception will it'll only be granted to you for a little while. and then you'll be off to the races again, and just swing the sword. And or to go back to Jiashan's, he says, otherwise, if you don't, the fisherman stays in the nest. So, nest. So, the moral of the story is, go fishing. Everyone, go fishing. That's our job. Don't stay in the nest. Don't stay home. Go out fishing. You know, even the ancient people weren't necessarily didn't necessarily have the greatest metaphors. You must directly swing the sword, otherwise the fisherman stays in the nest. Okay. So, do you want to say something, have some questions, have some dialogue about what I've said tonight? Am I doing well? Pretty good. Yes, Oscar. Oh, he has a mic. It's always a good idea to give Oscar a mic. He can be relied on to ask a question.
I wish it was so. Thanks very much, Jim. That's a lovely talk.
I think you have to just hold it closer, maybe.
How is this?
That's good. Eat the mic, yeah.
So I think this is, it struck me while you were speaking that the sword is a good metaphor. I've heard it before, but it opened up a little bit for me, because there is a very active effort involved for me in letting the productions of the mind go time after time after time, moment after moment. It's hard, really, to maintain that effort for me. And it's hard to remember that the necessity of, I think you brought up perseverance at some point, but of thinking of it as a training that has to be repeated time after time after time in order to build that muscle, as it were. Maybe that's going too far. But anyway, in the moment, there's an effort required to know, let that thought, that lovely thought, that pervasive and insistent thought, let it go. It's not even a, even if it's not a thought in words, but it's just an attention outside. Something like that.
Yeah. Another way, you know, teachers put it is, you know, don't believe in the production. I don't, you know, I've heard teachers say, I don't believe in the productions of my mind. Like, I don't really give them ultimate. And that in itself, if because we are taken in, we are so often taken in by the productions of our mind. And it's tricky because we're not talking about ignoring them or disavowing them exactly. It's not exactly that, but maybe it's best to say just not clinging to them, not clinging to those productions. They are real. I mean, to a certain extent, they're real in the extent that they often discourage us or push us around. They're real in that sense, but to reach this point of not identifying with them, not identifying with those productions, is a very valuable insight, a very, very important insight. That you see something coming up and you just understand it as, you know, what does somebody say? Somebody say like the tears of the mind or the saliva of the mind. I mean, it's just the productions, in other words. It's just like the productions of any gland that you have.
I've heard less polite analogies.
Yes. Oh. Secretions. That's a good word. Yeah.
I think it's expressed also in the harmony or difference, inequality. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a word I was going to use was independence. We in practice foster our independence from the productions of the mind. We actually foster that.
That's swinging the sword, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think Larry wanted to speak.
Somebody beat me to the punch because as you were talking, I was reminded of Uchiyama Roshi's statement as to what the thought, the relationship of thoughts to mind, and it was actually uttered by Norman Fisher in a talk that was just released 2 days ago on YouTube from Green Gulch, secretions of the mind.
Mm.
So if we could think of like our nose running on a windy day in the winter, maybe we could say, well, I don't identify with the drip out of my nose. Why should I identify with the secretions of the mind? You know, so just one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Hello. Is there a point, though, when you're in this main channel that wisdom, in a different way, wisdom comes up? A thought that you, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. Or, I don't know, a valid thought, not just something you're trying to cast aside.
No.
Like, isn't there like this relaxation and then wisdom?
Yes, absolutely. There is there are definitely wholesome productions of the mind. I don't want to, imply that there are not. There are wholesome productions of the mind that also, might not be clung to, but nevertheless are encouraging of further effort and further investment in practice. There are definite wholesome productions of the mind and insights such as you were referencing. You didn't give me any specific, but any. Oh no, oh, I'm sure you do. But yeah, in any case, and it's possible to. When the mind is, when we are settled, when we are really settled in zazen, it's not inappropriate to, if we have some wholesome insight, it's not inappropriate to develop that insight, even cognitively, without getting too carried away, but. It can be noted, and I often, after zazen, I often go to a notebook and I write some things down that I felt were wholesome. I hardly ever write down anything that, like, the stupid stuff, the garbage that comes up. But I used to do that. When I was young, I'd write down all the garbage, but I don't do that anymore. I wait for some good stuff to come, and then I write that down, and I find that useful. And Dorley has a question, comment.
Well, this is one of my most favorite koans.
Hmm.
Can you hear me? Because it doesn't sound like my voice. Okay. Okay. Is that better? So, but I have a sort of different way that I've encountered it, I guess you might say, because when you think of the statement, the fisherman has to leave the nest. Well, fishermen don't live in nests. So already there's some kind of conundrum here. So, but when you think about what it means to live in a nest, it's a very comfortable, it's you're protected, you haven't quite even been born yet, somebody's taking care of you. So it's sort of like I'm getting the message, you have to leave your comfort zone. And how do we even know what our comfort zones are? Even paying attention to, if I'm going along, sometimes I don't even realize that I just walked away fast from a situation because I was feeling uncomfortable. How do we keep, that's a different way, I guess, of practicing with this koan, is noticing, trying to catch when we're, rather stay in the nest, so to speak.
Mm.
And I did this workshop with some people in Japan using this koan and asked them to wonder, you know, where in their lives are they stuck in the nest? You know, what way are you living a way of your life that's more comfortable, but it also is stuck because it's narrow or confined, and kind of work with that. So anyway, I just wanted to share that, that take the image itself. A fisherman doesn't live in a nest, literally, anyway.
Yeah, I had a take on the fisherman. But anyway, your point, it has nothing to do with your point, which is another angle, and thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Yes, Glenn?
Yes, two things, really. When you started talking about our collection of bodhisattva action figures, I instantly wondered, do any of them come with kung fu grip? And the other thing was... you know, the fisherman leaving the nest brought to mind a children's book that I read when I was quite young called The Story of Ping, who was a cormorant. And, you know, the Chinese use cormorants to fish in the Yangtze River. It is a bird, and they do live in nests. So
that was actually my take on that story. After many years, I thought, oh, that's what they mean.
Yeah. Dora Lee brought it to mind for me when I was listening to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think nests are meant to be left. Nothing remains in a nest. They empty of themselves. And I'm really struck by your talk and some of the things that come up in the chant that we chanted tonight. And I think the line goes something like, and when erroneous imaginings cease, you know, what then?
Then the acquiescent mind realizes itself.
Self. So then what use is that sword?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but how did the erroneous imaginations may have ceased by ceaseless examining of the erroneous imaginations?
That sounds complicated. I like it. It's also possible that one just gives up any notion of the sword or imaginings or any of that. Just kind of becomes sort of steps forward to the leading edge of one's experience, not knowing.
Leading edge?
Yeah, the leading edge.
No, we don't need to, you know, be attached to our metaphors or mix them. But I understand your point. Okay, one more. Please.
Sometimes you just get lucky. And the sword is swung and the freedom is there. But I think I've heard illumination comes by luck. Zazen makes you, or by accident, better. Zazen makes you accident prone. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And the concentration that sometimes to stay, the effort of will to stay in the empty place. To not give up, to not allow that thought to sweep you away. it's an effort of will, but it somehow it can lead to an activity or result that has nothing to do with will. It seems paradoxical.
Oh, no, it was while you were in Montana, I think. There was a segment from Heejee G. Kim's Dogen Mystical Realist. Mm-hmm. Either that or the Zui Monkey. I can't remember which text it came from. But the tenet of it was that none of this is done from our own effort. You know, like you say, an accident prone or dependent origination. I mean, things happen, but it's not from our own doing. And so there is a sword that swings, but to think that it's in our hand might not be quite accurate. Just a thought.
Nothing happens, from our own doing. But neither is anything independent of our is there any awakening independent of our doing? Practice is requisite actually for all but a very few very special beings, called arhats or, self-enlightened ones, people that are just spontaneously awake. And there are a few of those people around the world. They pop up now and again, seemingly without any prior practice or, seemingly as a just a function of their particular amazing birth. Those people don't come to here. That maybe they teach us somewhere, but they don't really need to come here. And so this practice is for people that think they need to do something. and then discover that a lot of the doing that they thought they had to do really wasn't necessary, but they had to come and do a lot of stuff first. That's at least the case with me. I mean, I had to do a lot of practice and thinking I was doing something to arrive someplace where I could say, oh, yeah, that's okay. Everything's really okay, nothing special. Nothing really needed to do. No, there's no really nothing to do. But usually I have that kind of feeling after I've been working hard, in this practice. Usually that's when that feeling arises. Oh, it's so easy. And teachers say this, right? The way is not difficult. Just not difficult. And we can arrive at that place, but usually we arrive at it after a lot of difficulty.
That's part of the. I don't know. It's an incredible conundrum, really.
Yeah.
Because without the devotion to the practice, the possibility of awakening is much less. And yet, at the same time, the practice is about letting go of all control. Because you never know, and it's beyond our comprehension when it comes through. So I don't know. I guess that's what faith is, because you have the faith that this is the promise.